You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Ash. Efai Akine coming up on the show. I speak to Palestinian New Zealander Tamim al-Sheltoni about the bombing of the Al Ali Baptist Hospital in Gaza. For City Councilling, I speak to Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson about Te Hongo Ngā Akoranga, COMET, an organisation addressing education disparities in local communities, becoming an independent organisation from the Auckland Council, and recycled fabric billboards in Henderson Massey. I interview 350 Aotearoa campaigner Adam Curry about their protest at Parliament this week, calling on the incoming government to prioritise the climate in coalition negotiations. I also chat to Oxfam's Climate Justice Lead, Nick Henry, and stand-up co-convener Justine Sachs about their calls for the incoming government when it comes to the climate and workers' rights.
Ash, what have you got for us today?
I speak to CEO of Global Women, Agnes Mera, about the impact of menopause on employees.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today. So get in touch, tuku patuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō hi paki heri rohi rohi mauronga i te pai, tuku tuku o Enerangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com, and you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yesterday, the Al Ali Baptist Hospital in Gaza was bombed, killing at least 500 Palestinians. The Health Ministry in Gaza says the attack was a result of an Israeli air raid. Israel has attributed the explosion to a misfired rocket launched by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PIJ, which the PIJ has denied.
A statement issued by the World Health Organization pointed out that there have been over 50 attacks on healthcare facilities in Gaza since October 7th. Al Jazeera has reported that the Israeli military has issued evacuation orders for 22 hospitals. A senior health official in Gaza told Al Jazeera that the Israeli Defense Force had fired two artillery shells as a warning at the Al Ali Baptist Hospital days before the bombing.
Palestinian New Zealander and advocate Tamim al-Sheltoni is among those calling on the New Zealand government to condemn the Israeli government's genocide of Palestinians. I spoke to al-Sheltoni about the bombing of the Al Ali Baptist Hospital, Israel's genocide of Palestinians, and false information that has been spread by Israel during the Israel-Hamas war. I started off our interview asking al-Sheltoni about the attack on the Al Ali Baptist Hospital. Here is that interview.
So we saw yesterday the news about the targeting with an airstrike of Al Ahli Hospital in Gaza. It's very devastating news. It's horrific crime. Al Ahli Hospital in Gaza is like every other hospital and medical facility in Gaza right now. They're all way over capacity. They're treating tens of thousands of injured people in the bombing. This is in addition to the day-to-day operations. So I think you can imagine how overstretched they are right now. In addition to that, I heard it from a doctor from Al Ahli Hospital. They have been operating on the floor of the rooms because there's not enough beds, there's not enough chairs. It's just on the floor. They're treating the wounded. Along with the wounded people, there are families as well. These are their support families. Some of them actually they are taking shelter in the hospital because their homes are either already gone under bombing, or maybe they received evacuation orders, so they sought refuge in the hospital. They thought it was safe, but apparently it wasn't. I saw one video just before the bombing, I think one day before the bombing, in the courtyard of the hospital, there were tens of children playing and singing in the courtyard. I'll come to this point later, but this is just important details. In terms of the attack itself, first of all, let me clarify, Israel previously targeted hospitals, ambulances, and military staff in this current war and the previous occasions. So it's not the first time. It's not surprising. It's shocking, but it's not surprising. Also, Israel gave clear warnings to all of Gaza's hospitals in the last couple of days to evacuate. And even the World Health Organization condemned these warnings, because there was no way to evacuate hospitals packed with wounded people, and there's no other place to go. All of these hospitals, they received the same warning, and they just decided to carry on because, you know, there's no other option. The attack happened yesterday morning time, New Zealand, and immediately after the attack, after treating the wounded or who could recover, the hospital management, they organized a press release live on air on TV. I saw it on Al Jazeera. It was like nothing I've seen before. The press conference was held in the front and on top of bodies on the floor because there was no space. They couldn't do it any other place, just bodies everywhere. So it was something from another world. And here, I just need to quote the words of one of the doctors, one of the senior doctors in Gaza, who was at the scene and at the press conference, because I think it's very important to hear his own words and how he described it. So this is Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta. He's a British-Palestinian plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He moved to Al Ahli Hospital for help just the day of the attack. And these are his exact words. As I moved towards the outside of the operating room and towards the emergency department, we could see bodies of children piled up, both dead and moving wounded. There were several who had been amputated, and I tended to a man who had his leg blown off at the thigh. There were body parts everywhere and bodies piled up in the courtyard of the hospital. This morning, when I drove into the hospital, I noticed how full the courtyard was with families who sought refuge inside the hospital, thinking it would be a safe haven. It's these very same families who are now either dead or critically wounded as a result of this attack. This is a war crime that the world has seen coming. Israel has been warning the entire world that it was going to attack Palestinian hospitals. End of citation. I think Ghassan said it all. I don't have more words on this.
U.S. President Joe Biden was among some people who have claimed that a Palestinian group is responsible for the attack on the hospital. Why are we seeing countries like the U.S. supporting these claims?
So, first of all, the U.S. isn't an unbiased actor here. The U.S. actively supported Israel in its attack, provided Israel with weapons, and repeated that statement, Israel has the right to defend itself, but Palestinians don't. So Israel is not a third party here. It is part of this crime against Palestinians. So personally, I wouldn't take anything from Israel, from Americans, in the same way that I don't accept any Israeli claim. Israel is notorious for making lies against Palestinians. We hear these lies over and over, like Nakba in 1948, the big wave of ethnic cleansing. Israel has always been saying, we didn't do it, Palestinians just fled their homes, which is a big lie. We saw it just like the year before about Shirin Abu Akleh. the Palestinian journalist who Israel shot and killed in the occupied West Bank. They lied all the way about this process. We saw it in 2018 with Razan al-Najjar, who was killed by a sniper on the Gaza borders. We saw these lies from the Israelis about Palestinians using a human shield. And we saw this before, I think in 2014, Israel struck one hospital in Gaza, Al-Wafa Hospital, with 15 missiles. They fabricated evidence from 2009, and eventually, after some time, they admitted that they did it. So we keep seeing these lies. The reason they keep peddling these lies is to distract us from what is going on right now in Gaza, which is an active extermination. It's a genocide. And I think this is where all of us need to focus right now.
We saw today that Israel is planning to ban the reputable news outlet Al Jazeera. What do you think this says about the narrative the Israeli government is attempting to present about the Israel-Hamas war?
Israel is trying to shut down any voices, dissent voices, and people reporting on the truth. Israel wants to control the narrative. There's no democracy. There's no innocent body who can ban free speech and the freedom of the press unless they were planning to do massive atrocities and they don't want the people to hear. It's like it's equivalent to cops just turning off their body cam while they're torturing the detained person. It's the same example or same process.
What would your calls be to the government here in New Zealand to prevent more atrocities from happening in Gaza?
I have been working closely with outspoken people from the Palestinian community. We formed like a group, coordinating group, just to make sure we are organizing our efforts. And we put out a call to everyone, a call to action that included few demands or requests that we would like our government, New Zealand government, to undertake. First one was to condemn the Israeli assault on Gaza and to do what it takes to stop it by all means, diplomatically, going to the UN, all these different various ways. We also want our government to cut ties with Israel and apply sanctions against Israel, just like what we did with Russia, because that is the right thing to do, and we cannot have healthy relationships and ties with a state that is involved in committing war crimes and crimes against the humanity, such as genocide and ethnic cleansing. We also want our government to send immediate humanitarian aid to Gaza, because at the moment they're running out of food, they're running out of medical supplies, they don't have water, and they need every single help that we can provide them with.
People here in Aotearoa, individuals who might want to show their support for Palestinians, how can they do that?
Yeah, at the moment there are many rallies and the protests being organized in the main cities and regions. So I really recommend people, they keep an eye on the social media, on the Palestine Solidarity pages, just to keep track of these different events, and if they can attend an event that is close to them, I think this is really great. It shows support, and basically it changes the public opinion over time. We also want to put the pressure on the government, so anything people can do in order to put that pressure, I think it's great. Like if you know an MP, if you know a minister, new, current, give them a call, send them a letter, and just ask them that New Zealand does the right thing about this genocide that is happening right now and in front of our eyes.
That was Palestinian New Zealander and advocate Tamim Al-Sheltoni on the current situation in Gaza.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Burst into Motat Labour Weekend for Ngā Meru Meru Bubbles.
Get foamy, fizzy and poppy with a weekend of bubble-tastic activities.
You can catch a bubble, paint with bubbles, watch a bubble show, or even get inside a giant bubble. plus heaps more.
MoTeT will be bubbling over with excitement suited for the whole whānau.
Ngā miru miru bubbles. Find out more at motet.nz.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Ponsonby Social Club presents Asian Soundscapes, a month of Pan-Asian ecstasy, Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays in October.
The very best local Pan-Asian creatives are set to immerse you in a rich tapestry of Pan-Asian music, comedy and culinary delight.
Featuring Angela Dravid, Club Ruby, DJ Karen Tahir, Phoebe Rings, Ray Leslie, Scalper and heaps more.
Plus a special kitchen pop-up by Naaman and the Strawberry Pig.
Asian Soundscapes at the Ponsonby Social Club, Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays this October. Tickets available from Under the Radar.
Oh, what a day. I love e-scootering. The great outdoors, Richmond Road.
Oh, I've been loving that new Drill Wave Crew synthesis with a C.
Well, we're signed up to My Music Bag. It's so flex. Whatever you're into, they send the same but different stuff in ready-to-bang portions.
Isn't that kind of cheating? I mean, I'm old school. Suggested YouTube videos, Shazam stuff off Netflix. And don't you have all those leftover bass lines?
Obviously, I donate the bass lines here at Vinny's.
The Swap Meet. Old Collector Guys bring you disco, boogie, funk, and soul to get you cooking. The Swap Meet with Jabden Kirk. Sundays 4 till 7 on 95 BFM.
Oi, don't leave your baselines lying around here.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95 BFM. Our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM. For City Counselling this week, I spoke to Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson about Te Hongona Akoranga Comet, an organisation addressing education disparities in local communities, becoming an independent organisation from the Auckland Council. We also discussed a new local initiative, Recycled Fabric Billboards, in Henderson Massey. We started off our interview discussing why Te Hongona Akoranga Comet is separating from the council.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and I think it's a really cool landmark for this organisation known as Comet to move from being a CCO, which is a council-controlled organisation, into something more independent that they can go and seek funding from different places in a much easier way. It's a little bit more relaxed and a bit more sort of flexible for them as well. It's something that we both parties have been really keen to progress. And I'm just proud as chair of the committee that oversees this, that we can achieve this. It's pretty cool. I only got appointed a few months ago, and it's good to get some runs on the board. But anyway, Comet, basically what it is it's an organisation that promotes educational outcomes in Auckland, and it focuses on the greatest needs areas in Auckland, largely Manukau, but also they work in West Auckland as well and work in different parts here and there as well. It's essentially getting people on their feet and getting their education sorted so they can sort of grow as people and become role models in their community and all those kind of good things. So, yeah, for them to take that step, I think it's after 24 years of CCO, that's a beautiful thing.
Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown has commended the organisation for stepping away from the council and going out into the real world. What do you think he meant by this?
I don't know if the analogy is appropriate, but it's kind of an organisation grows with you as much as your sort of kids do in your own home, and then eventually that they sort of move out and find their own ways in the world and more of their own kind of vision without sort of the parental control. And, you know, when they do this, they don't have to come through to my committee and do big accountability mechanisms and those kind of things. They're free from all of that. They can focus a little bit more on their work and go and pick up different funders and things that might have been a bit more difficult under the previous regime. So I think Mayor Brown was kind of drawing on that analogy.
How will the council continue to focus on barriers to accessing education in our communities?
Yeah, it's very much something that we'll continue to be doing in terms of working on the education side of things. It's actually a legal requirement as part of Council's Four Wellbeings and the Local Government Act. We have to focus on the wellbeing of our community, and education is such a key part of that. We're going to be continuing to work with Comet as best we can and partnering where they wish to as well. That's certainly it's the end of the more formal relationship, but it does mean that a relationship can continue and maybe on a bit more flexible terms.
I also wanted to talk to you about a new initiative in Henderson Massey, which is Recycled Fabric Billboards. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
Yeah, I got a shout out to the Henderson Massey Local Board. They're doing a fantastic job with this. So real estate signs, election signs, event signs, they come on sort of a plastic normally, which is called Corflute. And it's, you know, not necessarily environmentally friendly. We try and recycle these things as best we can, give them to, you know, places that do rabbit hutches and art and things like that. But Henderson Massey kind of looked at the situation and said, look, we're going to take this really seriously and we're going to go next level with this. They use recycled fabric billboards. So it's all 100% recycled, and yeah, that will be the first choice for all future events and festivals within the Henderson Massey local board. And it's just a real commitment to reducing waste and highlighting sustainability.
Is this something that you would encourage the council to look at for other areas in Tamaki Makaurau?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd encourage council as a broader organisation to look at the fantastic example that's being set right here in West Auckland, and shout out to the chair and deputy, Chris Carter and Brooke Loader there for their sort of leadership on this issue. I think that as a city we could be learning from what we do in the West generally, but particularly with this.
That was Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson talking about Te Hongona Akurunga Comet separating from the Auckland Council and recycled fabric billboards in Henderson Massey.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
A survey by the New Zealand Institute of Economics, as commissioned by the non-profit Global Woman in ANZ, studied the impact of employees experiencing menopause in the workplace. The study focused on the symptoms of menopause, its effects on employee abilities, and highlighted the stigma surrounding potential discussions between an employer and their workers. I spoke to CEO of Global Women, Agnes Nero, about their report and started by asking about the purpose of the survey.
The purpose was, look, I think we would all agree that menopause is not well thought about, not well talked about. And the purpose of this one was really to understand the experience of women and employers, so it was focused in the workplace.
And for those who might not be aware, what kind of symptoms are experienced during menopause and who is most affected?
Just remembering, I'm not a doctor, but there's two stages, I suppose, that there's that perimenopause, and that's what leads up to menopause, and then menopause. The research, global research, tells us that most women experience that between the ages of 45 and 55. Some women might have no symptoms. Some women experience the symptoms in terms of hot flushes, or that they feel they're not functioning, their brain is not functioning as well. So yeah, look, I'd be really careful because I don't have a medical background, and I don't want to kind of minimise the experience for women.
What insight did the survey provide into employees' perceptions of menopause in Aotearoa?
Well, what was interesting in the survey is that employers were certainly open to addressing and having those conversations and having a look at how they could, I suppose, curate the right conditions for women. And some of those already exist if organisations have flexible working, if they have wellness leave, which many of them do. So women don't necessarily have to say, well, I'm taking it because I'm menopausal, but you can take that on those, you know, if you're not feeling 100%, I'm going to work from home. So there are some policies in organisations or conditions in organisations that do allow women to be able to manage through that. So employers would definitely. The surprising thing for me, and shouldn't be really, there is certainly a stigma for us as women with this idea about even talking about menopause. And we had an event last night, Global Women had an event that we hosted. And we had Nikki Bizard, who writes books about menopause in the workplace, and Dr. Linda Deer, who is a menopausal doctor. In terms of, and they talk through, you know, that stigmatisation, this idea that, you know, if you were remembering, if that's the age we're talking about, that many women would be at the top of their careers. And so having to own the idea that you're not performing as well as you think you should, and what that might do in terms, and these are just perceptions of ours, in terms of our ability to get a promotion or, you know, or get something that's really important to us in terms of strategic project. So that shouldn't be surprising, but I was surprised at how many women felt that it's not something they do want to talk about, although they do experience it being affecting or impacting their experience at work. I mean, there was a couple of things, you know, that kind of woman talked about, you know, the loss of motivation or interest in all of those. But I think that idea that employers were open to it and women were less likely to want to raise it.
As you mentioned, employers were happy to discuss this with their employees, and around 80% of menstruating people experience these symptoms in the 12 months following their last period. However, part of your survey found that 94% of employers had no concerns on their ability to work. Why do you think this is?
Oh, look, we talked about that last night and that, but as you get older, this idea that you're not, you know, because lots of things can happen, that's our perception that we're not up to performing. That what we might say is that because we perform at 150%, if we're only performing at 100%, we still don't think that's good enough. So that's something that, you know, that many women experience. We think, are we good enough? You know, am I doing it? So again, in the survey, the employers don't notice it. They're not saying that women are underperforming or their performance has changed. And that's a bigger story. That's not just about menopause. That's just about women's journey in terms of their working careers. And we all have moments, and sometimes longer moments, about whether we're still, you know, that we're performing at our best.
Do you think much has changed in terms of acknowledging the challenges of menstruation in work over the past 30 years?
Oh, well, certainly in the last 30 years, but that's probably only happened in the last maybe 5 or 6, you know, because, look, you know, if I think about back to my aunties and my mothers and that, it wasn't even talked about in our homes. And I don't think that's just about, I mean, I'm Māori and I know that those things weren't, but what I heard last night from non-Māori and non-Pacific women is the same thing. This wasn't discussed at home. So certainly we've moved because there's more discussion. I mean, we have, you know, someone like Dr. Linda Deer, who is a menopausal doctor. So definitely move. Definitely, I think, you know, there's been a number of things that have happened in workforces, from kind of domestic violence policies to parental leave. I mean, we've seen a huge shift in what's being offered in terms of both parental leave for both parents. So I think menopause is moving with that, not at the same pace, because it's not something that we've started to raise a conversation in this country. It's fairly new. But yes, we certainly have. I think it's been talked about more at homes. We did acknowledge last night, though, that we ourselves probably don't talk about it enough with each other. And that would give us confidence to talk about it in the workplace. And again, but those conversations, like other conversations, need to start in our homes to build up confidence for us then to be starting to think about. There's some really good practices in some of the organisations, and there's definitely in the UK, they have these things called menopause cafes at work, so women can kind of come together. And because the challenge is, you know, if you're a woman of 45 and your boss happens to be male and 30, having that conversation would not be helpful for you and probably not helpful for them. So yes, definitely we've seen some moves, but part of why we did this research was actually to work alongside others, like Nikki Pazant, like Linda Deer and others, to, you know, amplify this conversation about menopause in the workplace.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that's all. But again, you know, as we said last night, you know, the questions, what can employers do, what can women do? And that's really, how do we normalise, and we have normalised other things, how do we normalise this kaupapa around menopause? And that's really, that's all of us talking. So look, you know, we would say that yes, there's a place for policy, but actually really it's just that attitude, or how do we have those conversations? How do we involve men in those conversations? Because they're as much a part, it's a bit like, you know, parental leave. That's not just about women, that's about an experience for a family. Similarly, menopause is an experience for families, for communities. So that would be it, that we continue to advocate, we make sure that this conversation keeps going, that it's not just about a menopause day, but this is something that happens all of the time. And our hope would be that the generation, the next generation, it just becomes a norm. There's not having to, you know, raise the idea or that stigma. I mean, if we could remove that stigma about menopause, it would be life-changing for all of us, men and women.
That was Agnes Nera from Global Woman discussing the recent findings of a survey on menopause in the workplace.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
and we'll be right back after this short break.
Citizens of Auckland, prepare for the event of the year. Get your geek on at Armageddon Expo.
New Zealand's most exciting gaming and pop culture event of the year.
Meet stars from Star Trek, The Last of Us, Mandalorian, Walking Dead, Tokyo Ghoul, Tokyo Ghoul, and more. Plus huge gaming displays, collectibles galore, anime, K-pop, cosplay, pop culture, collectibles, and so much more.
Armageddon, this weekend, at Auckland Showgrounds. Tickets on the door or go to iticket.co.nz.
Morningside Live Block Party is back.
With a stacked lineup co-headlined by Avondale Bowling Club and the Betts, local brews and yummy kai. It's going to be stellar.
Want to win a ticket? Just listen to BFM Drive all week for your chance to win. Don't forget to have your B-card handy.
95BFM presents Morningside Live Block Party 2024. March 31st, McDonald Street, Morningside, Auckland. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back to 95BFM's News and Current Affairs show, The Wire. Protesters led by climate activist group 350 Aotearoa took to Parliament to call on the incoming government to prioritise climate solutions that will cut emissions and address the cost of living in coalition negotiations. First, I spoke to 350 campaigner Adam Curry about the purpose of their protest.
Our purpose was to send a really clear message to the incoming government that they need to act on climate, invest in community renewable projects, and retain existing policies such as the ban on oil and gas exploration.
What are your specific calls to the incoming government when it comes to climate action and reducing emissions?
We're calling on the government to invest in community-based energy projects, and that's because we know that community energy projects reduce power prices for whānau, where we're having hundreds of thousands of people in energy poverty right now, and it actually makes our grid more resilient to events such as Cyclone Gabrielle. So community-based energy projects are our focus because, you know, it reduces power, it reduces emissions, it makes our whānau more able to access the power that we need.
Is there any climate legislation that you're concerned could be stalled or scrapped under the new government?
Yeah, there are a range of retrograde policy changes in the pipeline, but it's Prime Minister-elect Christopher Luxon's horror promise to repeal New Zealand's ban on new offshore oil exploration that's the most regressive. The International Energy Agency has been very clear that if we are to avoid catastrophic climate change, there can be no more oil and gas exploration. You know, everyone deserves to have a thriving ocean without the risk of catastrophic oil spills, and we all have the right to a safe climate and a future in which Earth can sustain life in all its diversity, and so restarting oil exploration puts that all at risk.
How might the incoming government's expressed views on co-governance impact climate action, in your opinion?
Oh, absolutely, it will impact climate action. I think we know that Māori-led solutions reduce emissions. Māori communities have been, you know, living in climate harmony for centuries, and so threats to co-governance is a massive threat to the climate. You know, we're all in this together. Climate is about working together. It's about valuing all solutions. And right now, Māori-led climate action is not being valued. It is not being resourced. So we're calling for the government to cease its sort of racist talk on co-governance and actually back and invest in Tino Rangatiratanga, meaning Māori-led projects to implement the solutions that our Indigenous communities know work.
And the economy is a priority of the incoming government, we've seen. How can climate action economically benefit Aotearoa?
Yeah, well, we know that $1 invested in climate action gives $5 of benefit to the community. So investing in climate action makes great economic sense. You know, clean energy creates three times as many jobs as fossil fuels do. So climate action creates good, clean, you know, living wage union jobs for all of us. It benefits our economy, helps us get to where we live, work and play. It makes our communities thrive. It just really makes good economic sense, and it does not make good economic sense to invite oil companies into New Zealand with the profits going offshore that don't give out anything to our economy or to our communities.
The incoming government is also expected to focus on building roads over more climate-friendly transport options. What do you make of this?
Well, an investment in roads to nowhere don't help our climate, and they don't help our economy, and they don't help us get around. You know, we know that just building more roads, people use those roads, and it doesn't help congestion at all. Building more roads is not what we want to do. If you actually want to reduce congestion, you want to be enabling people to get into public and active transport, enabling people to fill up cars more, and to discourage private vehicles so that people who do have to drive can actually get to where they need to go. But investing in roads is economic madness. It may be a very short-term popular electoral policy, but building roads ultimately doesn't help our economy, and it's investment in clean, active public transport that actually will help us get around, that will get people to businesses and spending money in our communities, and it will save the climate that we all rely on.
What plans do you have as 350 Aotearoa to continue to lobby the incoming government for climate action?
New Zealand has fought long and hard to stop oil exploration, and New Zealanders are proud of that win in a similar way to that they're proud of New Zealand's nuclear-free status. So, you know, if the government even tries to reverse the ban on oil and gas exploration, they need to be prepared for hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders to rise up to take action to protect the climate that we all love. You know, New Zealanders really care about climate action. We've seen this through the parties that campaign hard on climate, Te Pāti Māori and the Greens, did well electorally. So the government is going to face massive resistance if they try to roll back or do not deliver on the climate policies that we need. People in Aotearoa know that climate change is here, right? Any rollback of climate action would be a slap in the face to those from the East Coast or Tamaki Makaurau who are still putting their lives together after the floods this year.
I also spoke to Oxfam Climate Justice Lead Nick Henry about what they would like to see from the incoming government when it comes to climate action. Here is that interview. What do you think these parties being in power could mean for climate action in Aotearoa?
We need to wait and see and give them a chance to lay out the plan once they form a government, because part of the question has been how the parties that will form our next government plan to meet the targets that all parties have agreed to under the Climate Change Response Act or the Zero Carbon Act amendments to that, to get to net zero by 2050, to reduce our emissions significantly by the end of this decade. And the incoming Prime Minister and National Party have said they agree with those targets, so we need to see what they're going to do and give them time to do that. There are some areas where we do have concerns. So Oxfam Aotearoa has been very consistent in calling for a just transition away from oil and gas production and definitely an end to exploration for new oil and gas in Aotearoa. And there have been some worrying signs that the new government might seek to expand the oil and gas industry further by reopening offshore exploration. We think that would be a mistake, and that's something that we call on the new government, once they have a chance to form, to really take a pause to look at the evidence on that, because the evidence is mounting globally, is really established globally, that there is no room for new oil and gas development or exploration within the global climate goals that have been set in the Paris Agreement. In fact, if we're to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees, as our government and all governments have agreed, we have to actually leave more than half, nearly 60% of the known oil and gas reserves in the ground if we're to have even a 50% chance of keeping to those sort of guardrails, those last safety barriers to avoid the most extreme of the climate crisis that would otherwise be coming. So we need actually to plan now a managed decline of that industry, a just transition that avoids serious disruption to jobs, which would happen if we just left it until the last minute to make a plan. And also industry needs to think about not investing in ways that are going to strand their assets in a declining industry. So a responsible government would take stock of that evidence that the International Energy Agency is saying that demand will decline for oil, gas and coal this decade. The demand is peaking and is starting to decline, and there really isn't a future for this industry, so it would be counterproductive and quite dangerous to start exploring for new offshore production at a time when we need to be actually managing a decline.
National and ACT in particular have also said that they want to build more roads over low emissions transport options, and they would also increase the price of public transport, taking away that half price subsidy that's currently in place. What impact do you believe this would have?
Well, the thing is that public transport that's accessible, meaning that, you know, we need to expand our network so that everyone as much as possible can access public transport to get where they need to go, accessible in terms of access for disabled people, and accessible in terms of affordable as well. So either free or subsidised public transport is really essential. That's one of the easiest and most popular things that you can do for climate action that also benefits reducing the cost of living. So Oxfam Aotearoa and other organisations that care about climate justice would like to see an expanded public transport network. And there are various ways to do that. So, you know, I'm interested to see what the new government wants to prioritise, whether it's light rail or heavy rail or buses or, you know, electric buses or other alternatives. But we do need to see an expansion of the public transport and active transport, walking and cycling network. It's good for climate justice, but it's also just good for communities and good for choice, and actually good for people who need to drive because it reduces congestion as well. So we think that the new government will come in with a balance, and they'll need to assess where that balance is. But public transport, expanding our public transport network, is the big challenge of the future. Sure, you need to maintain roads, but we really need to expand our public transport network.
Are there any policies of National and ACT that you've seen that you support?
Well, so like I say, there's a difference between what parties say in an election when they're appealing to their base and supporters, and what a government can do once they've got access to all of the advice from their ministries and the public, and once they're governing for all people in Aotearoa. And so it's an unknown, and it's a time when we need to be giving our voices to call on the government to take strong action for the climate and for our communities. And I think that there is potential to find common ground where the National Party and the people who will form the new government have said that they believe in the goals of reducing our emissions. Actually, one thing I agree with is that we need to be doing more of that action here in Aotearoa, supporting New Zealand to bring down our own emissions rather than paying other countries to do it for us through this kind of international offsetting thing. I mean, that's a bit technical, but it is something that these parties have criticised in opposition. So if they're going to come out with a plan to reduce New Zealand's emissions further and avoid that cost that Treasury said could be in the billions, you know, over $3 billion if we were to pay other countries to do climate action for us, we'd like to see a plan for New Zealand to do that ourselves. And the other contribution that we do need to make is reducing our production of fossil fuels, because that's going to be on the agenda globally this year. And that's another thing, is that our new government will be representing all of us at these global meetings coming up. So right after the new government forms, 6th of November, whether it's the Prime Minister or Foreign Minister, the new government will be representing us at the Pacific Islands Forum in Rarotonga. And it would be really embarrassing, I think, for all of us if our new government was talking about reopening oil and gas exploration at a time when other Pacific leaders, our neighbours, are talking about a plan to end fossil fuel exploration and production entirely as part of a just transition to a fossil fuel-free Pacific. We know that's going to be on the agenda for the Pacific Island Forum, and so we would urge, you know, our new government to stand with the Pacific on that, support that goal, and take a pause on their plans for the industry in New Zealand until they can get the proper advice, consider the evidence, and we think they'll find the evidence doesn't stack up for new fossil fuel development. And then same in December, they'll be going to the UN climate talks in Dubai, COP28. And there, we know on the agenda, there'll be a push for a global phase out of fossil fuels. That's really number one on the agenda at those climate talks. So again, not a good time to be talking about reopening oil and gas exploration. That would be, I think, embarrassing for all of us. So better for New Zealand to line up with the Pacific and look for the future of renewable energy and look for how we can benefit from that industry and that emerging technology and development rather than the old fossil fueled path that's really not our future.
I also spoke to Justine Sachs from the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions group Stand Up, representing workers under 35, about their concerns about the incoming government when it comes to the climate and workers' rights. Here is that interview. So how is workers' rights connected to the climate crisis?
We're advocating for a just transition for the costs and the risks associated with the transition to not be borne by workers. We don't think that that's equitable. We don't think that's fair. And we want those workers to be taken care of. We also think how you build support for climate action by making sure that it's fair and that people are being taken care of as we transition away to a, you know, low carbon, no carbon economy. Yeah. So we've been doing a lot of work in like Taranaki and in places where, carbon intensive industries, where we have union members to prepare for a just transition and to advocate for a just transition. So very much deeply involved in, climate action and also like what the economy will look like as we transition.
Can you provide some insight on some of the challenges facing young workers or low-income workers in particular right now?
Workers are doing it really tough at the moment. We need climate action. We need a just transition. We need support during this cost of living crisis. We don't have a lot of confidence in the incoming government. They've run on, stripping back renters' rights. They want to take away fair pay agreements, which were due to give essential workers like bus drivers and supermarket workers, these workers that have got us through a really challenging period, especially during this pandemic. They want to take away their hard-earned pay increases. We think it's really wrong. We think we need to be really strong and stand in opposition from day one to what we think is going to be a very anti-worker government.
Are there any policies that you've seen from ACT or National that you think could potentially be beneficial or could be improved to support workers and the climate?
I haven't seen a single policy that I think will benefit workers. I think what they, in terms of how they can improve, I think they can retract their promises to repeal fair pay agreements, retract the promise to get rid of to repeal protections for renters. They want to put in no cause evictions. They want to put that back in. They can also commit to raising the minimum wage and to continue raising benefits above inflation in line with wage increases, which is what the Labor government was doing. So I think it's actually more about not doing things rather than policies that are particularly pro-worker.
Just lastly, what would your message be to the incoming government when it comes to equitable climate action?
It's not good enough. We need climate action now. We've been through, the past year has shown us how disruptive, we have been disrupted by the climate breakdown. We're all impacted. This is not the time to be repealing climate policy. This is not the time to be raiding the climate fund to pay for uncosted tax cuts. This is not the time to get rid of the clean car discount. This is not the time to repeal the ute tax. It's not the time to scale back our climate issues. Instead, we need to go harder and much, much faster. This is urgent. It's just not good enough. So we're not going to be standing idly by while, basically our future is being being put in peril by, frankly, irresponsible politicians.
That was Stand Up co-convener Justine Sachs and Oxfam's climate justice lead, Nick Henry, on the incoming government's plans for climate and workers' rights, as well as 350 Aotearoa campaigner Adam Curry.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hoka, hotaka katoa mo tine wiki ni te mihi ki a koutou katoa. I kororo mai ki o mo tine rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapare Wednesday. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Palestinian New Zealander Tamim Al-Sheltoni, Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson, Free 50 Aotearoa campaigner Adam Currie, Oxfam Climate Justice Lead Nick Henry, stand-up co-convener Justine Sachs, and CEO of Global Women Agnes Naira. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.